The Trial by Franz Kafka, concluded. Disc 7.
Well, what is there to say? Replied K, who was tired of seeing Fräulein Montag stare so fixedly at his lips. By this means she already assumed control over what he had yet to say. Apparently, Fräulein Bürstner doesn't wish to grant me the personal discussion I requested.
That's right, said Fräulein Montag, or rather, that's not it at all. You put it much too strongly. As a general rule, discussions are neither granted nor denied, but they may be considered unnecessary, as in this case. Now, after what you've said, I can speak frankly. You asked my friend, either in writing or orally, to discuss something with you. But my friend knows what this discussion would concern, or so I at least assume, and is therefore convinced, for reasons unknown to me, that it would be to no one's benefit for the discussion to actually take place. She mentioned it to me for the first time yesterday, by the way, and then only in passing. She said, among other things, that the discussion couldn't be all that important to you, for you could only have hit upon such an idea by chance, and that, even without a specific explanation, you would soon see how pointless the whole thing was, if you hadn't realized it already. I replied that she might be right, but nonetheless I felt that, in order to make everything perfectly clear, it might still be preferable to give you some explicit answer. I offered to take on this task myself, and after some hesitation my friend yielded. I hope I've acted as you would have wished too, for even the slightest uncertainty in the most minor matter is always annoying, and if, as in this case, the uncertainty can be dispelled so easily, it's best to do so at once.
I thank you, Kay replied at once, rose slowly, gazed at Fräulein Montag, then across the table, then out the window. The building opposite stood in sunlight, and walked toward the door. Fräulein Montag followed him for a few steps, as if she didn't trust him completely. But at the door they both had to draw back, for it opened and Captain Lanz entered. Kay saw him for the first time up close. He was a tall man of about 40, with a tanned, fleshy face. He made a slight bow, which was meant for Kay as well, then went up to Fräulein Montag and kissed her hand respectfully. He moved with easy assurance. His politeness toward Fräulein Montag differed strikingly from the treatment Kay had accorded her. Even so, Fräulein Montag didn't seem angry with Kay, for as far as he could tell, she was about to introduce him to the captain. But Kay had no desire for introductions. He felt incapable of showing any friendliness toward either the captain or Fräulein Montag, for in his eyes the kiss of her hand had united them as a pair that desired, beneath the appearance of utmost inoffensiveness and unselfishness, to keep him from seeing Fräulein Bürstner. Kay not only believed this, but felt as well that Fräulein Montag had selected an excellent, albeit two-edged weapon, to accomplish her aim. She exaggerated the importance of the relationship between Fräulein Bürstner and Kay, and, above all, the importance of the discussion he sought, while at the same time attempting to twist things around so that Kay seemed to be the one exaggerating everything. She would be proved wrong. Kay had no desire to exaggerate anything. He knew that Fräulein Bürstner was an ordinary little typist who couldn't resist him for long. In this connection, he deliberately omitted any consideration of what he had learned about Fräulein Bürstner from Frau Grubach. He was thinking about all this as he left the room with scarcely a nod. He intended to go straight to his room, but a little laugh he heard coming from Fräulein Montag in the dining room gave him an idea that would give both the captain and Fräulein Montag a surprise. He looked around and listened to see if an interruption might be expected from any of the adjoining rooms. It was quiet everywhere. The only sound was the conversation in the dining room and, from the hall leading to the kitchen, Frau Grubach's voice. It seemed like a good opportunity. Kay went to Fräulein Bürstner's door and knocked softly. Since nothing stirred, he knocked again. But there was still no response. Was she asleep? Or was she truly ill? Or just pretending she wasn't there because she sensed that only Kay would knock so softly? Kay decided she was pretending and knocked more loudly, and since his knocking went unanswered, finally opened the door cautiously, not without the feeling he was doing something wrong and pointless as well. There was no one in the room. Moreover, it scarcely resembled the room as Kay knew it. Two beds were now placed in a row against the wall, three armchairs near the door were piled high with clothes and undergarments, a wardrobe stood open. Fräulein Bürstner had probably departed while Fräulein Montag was talking to Kay in the dining room. Kay was not particularly thrown by this. He had hardly expected to find Fraulein Bürstner so easily. He had made this attempt largely to spite Fraulein Montag. That, however, made it all the more embarrassing when, as he was reclosing the door, he saw Fraulein Montag and the captain conversing in the open doorway of the dining room. They might have been standing there since the moment Kay first opened the door. They avoided any appearance of having been watching Kay. They were talking softly and merely followed Kay's movements with occasional glances, as people do without thinking in the midst of a conversation. But their glances weighed heavily upon Kay, and he hurried along the wall to reach his room. Public Prosecutor. In spite of the human insight and worldly experience Kay had acquired during his long period of service in the bank, the company at his regular table had always seemed to him unusually worthy of respect, and he never denied in his own mind that it was a great honour to belong to such a group. It consisted almost exclusively of judges, public prosecutors, and lawyers, to which were added a few quite young clerks and legal assistants, who, however, sat at the very end of the table, and were only allowed to join in the debates when questions were put directly to them. For the most part, such queries were intended only for the company's amusement, and public prosecutor Hasterer, who generally sat next to Kay, took particular pleasure in embarrassing the young men in this way. Whenever he spread out his strong, hairy hand in the middle of the table and turned toward its lower end, they all immediately pricked up their ears. And when someone there took up his question, but either failed from the very start to decipher it, or stared thoughtfully into his beer, or instead of speaking simply clamped his jaw shut, or even, that was the worst, broke into an impetuous flood of words to back up some erroneous or unverified opinion, then the older men shifted about in their chairs with a smile and seemed to be really enjoying themselves for the first time. Truly serious professional conversations remained their exclusive preserve. Kay had been introduced into this company by a lawyer, the bank's legal representative. At one period, Kay had been involved in several long conferences with this lawyer, which kept them at the bank late into the evening. And so it happened that he joined the lawyer for supper at his regular table and took pleasure in the company he found there. He considered them all scholarly, respectable, and relatively powerful gentlemen, whose relaxation consisted in trying to solve complex questions far removed from everyday life, and who worked hard to do so. If, as was natural, he was unable to join in to any great degree, he could still make use of the opportunity to learn a great deal that might sooner or later be of advantage to him at the bank, while establishing the sort of personal contacts with the court that were always useful. And those present seemed to enjoy his company as well. He was soon acknowledged as an expert in business, and his views on such matters were accepted, though not without a touch of irony, as the final word. It was by no means rare for two members who disagreed on some legal question to request Kay's view of the matter, and for Kay's name to recur in their subsequent statements and rejoinders, and be brought even into the most abstract analyses, which Kay had long since ceased to follow. Of course, he gradually came to understand a good deal, particularly since he had a good adviser at his side in Hasterer, the public prosecutor, who also drew closer to him as a friend. Kay even often accompanied him home at night, but it took a long time for him to grow used to walking arm in arm with this giant of a man, who could have hidden him quite unobtrusively in his cycling cape. In the course of time, however, they grew so intimate that all distinctions of education, profession, and age were gradually effaced. They acted as if they had always been together, and if one occasionally appeared superior to the other in the relationship, it was not Hasterer, but Kay, for in the end his practical experience usually proved correct, since it was gained so directly, as almost never happens at the courtroom table. This friendship was, of course, soon generally recognized at the table, and no one really remembered who had first introduced Kay into the company. By now, at any rate, it was Hasterer who stood behind Kay. If Kay's right to sit there was ever questioned, he was fully justified in calling on Hasterer for support. Kay thus achieved a particularly privileged position, for Hasterer was as respected as he was feared. The power and skill of his legal thought were no doubt admirable, but in this there were many who were at least his equal, yet no one matched the savagery with which he defended his opinions. Kay had the impression that if Hasterer couldn't convince his opponent, he at least frightened him, for many drew back when he merely raised his outstretched finger. It seemed as if the opponent had forgotten he was in the company of old acquaintances and colleagues, that the questions under discussions were, after all, merely theoretical, that there was no way anything could actually happen to him. Instead, he fell silent, and even shaking his head took courage. It was an almost painful sight when his opponent was sitting so far away, Hastura realized that no agreement was possible at such a distance, when he would shove back his plate of food and slowly rise to approach the man himself. Those close by would lean their heads back to observe his face. Of course, these incidents were relatively rare. For the most part, only legal questions excited him, and in particular those concerning trials he himself had conducted or was conducting. When such questions were not involved, he was friendly and calm. His laugh was kindly, and his passion devoted to food and drink. On occasion, he even ignored the general conversation, turned toward Kay, placed his arm on the back of his chair, questioned him in an undertone about the bank, then spoke of his own work, or even told stories about women he knew who kept him almost as busy as the court did. He was not to be seen conversing thus with any other person among the company, and in fact, if someone wanted to ask a favour of Hastura, generally it was to effect a reconciliation with some colleague, they came first to Kay and asked him to intercede, which he always did gladly and easily. He was in general quite polite and modest toward everyone, without exploiting his relationship with Hastura in any way, and, more important than politeness or modesty, he was capable of accurately assessing the rank of the various gentlemen, and knew how to treat each according to his station. Of course, Hastura constantly instructed him in this regard. It was the only set of rules Hastura himself never violated, even in the most heated debate. Thus Hastura never addressed the young men at the end of the table, who had almost no rank at all, in any but the most general of terms, as if they were not individuals, but merely an aggregate mass. But it was precisely these gentlemen who showed him the greatest respect. And when he arose around 11 o'clock to go home, there was always someone there to help him on with his heavy coat, and another who opened the door for him with a low bow, and who, of course, still held it open as Kay left the room behind Hastura. While in the beginning Kay would walk partway home with Hastura or Hastura with Kay, later such evenings generally ended with Hastura inviting Kay up to his apartment for a while. There they would sit for another hour over brandy and cigars. Hastura enjoyed these evenings so much that he didn't even want to forego them when he had a woman by the name of Helene living with him for a few weeks. She was a thick-set older woman with a yellowish complexion and black curls ringing her forehead. At first, Kay saw her only in bed. She usually lay there shamelessly, reading a serial novel and paying no attention to the gentleman's conversation. Only when it grew late would she stretch, yawn, and, if she could get his attention by no other means, even throw an installment of her novel at Hastura. Then he would rise with a smile, and Kay would take his leave. Later, of course, when Hastura began to tire of Helene, she was a major irritant during their evenings together. Now she always awaited the men fully clothed, and usually in a dress she no doubt considered expensive and becoming, but which was in reality an old, overly ornate ball gown with several embarrassing rows of long fringe dangling from it for decoration. Kay was unaware of the precise appearance of this dress, since he more or less refused to look at it, sitting for hours with eyes lowered while she swayed through the room or sat somewhere nearby. Later, in desperation, as her position became even less tenable, she even tried to make Hastura jealous by showing a preference for Kay. It was simply desperation and not spite that made her lean her bare, fat, round back across the table and bring her face close to Kay to get him to look up. All this accomplished was to keep Kay from going near Hastura's for a while, and when, after a time, he did come again, Helene had been sent away once and for all. Kay accepted that as a matter of course. That evening they spent a particularly long time together, drank a pledge to brotherhood at Hastura's suggestion, and Kay was almost a little tipsy on the way home from all the smoking and drinking. The very next morning, in the course of a business discussion, the president of the bank mentioned he thought he'd seen Kay the previous evening. If he wasn't mistaken, Kay had been walking arm in arm with Hastura, the public prosecutor. The president seemed to find this so striking that, totally in keeping with his usual precision, of course, he named the church beside which, near the fountain, the encounter had taken place. Had he wished to describe a mirage, he would not have expressed himself differently. Kay now explained that the public prosecutor was his friend, and that they had, in fact, passed by the church that evening. The president smiled in astonishment and asked Kay to take a seat. It was one of those moments that so endeared the president to Kay, moments in which a certain concern for Kay's well-being and his future surfaced in this weak, ill, coughing man weighed down with work of the highest responsibility, a concern that some, of course, might call cold and superficial, as other officers who had similar experiences with the president tended to do, simply a good way to bind valuable officers to him for years by sacrificing 2 minutes of his time. Be that as it may, Kay succumbed to the president in such moments. Perhaps the president spoke to Kay somewhat differently than he did to the others. It wasn't that he ignored his superior position and dealt with Kay on an equal footing, something he generally tended to do in everyday business affairs, but rather he seemed to disregard Kay's position altogether, speaking to him as if he were a child, or as if he were an inexperienced young man seeking his first job, who, for some unknown reason, had awakened the president's goodwill. Kay would certainly never have allowed himself to be spoken to in this way by anyone else, or even by the president himself, had the president's solicitude not appeared to him genuine, or at least had the possibility of this solicitude as it appeared in such moments not cast such a total spell upon him. Kay recognized his weakness. Perhaps it was based on the fact that in this respect there was indeed still something childlike about him, since without ever having experienced the care of his own father, who had died quite young, he had left home early, and had always tended to reject rather than elicit the tenderness of his mother, whom he had last visited some 2 years ago, and who, half blind, still lived out in the small, unchanging village. "I knew nothing of this friendship," said the president, and only a faint, friendly smile softened the severity of these words. To Elsa. One evening, shortly before quitting time, Kay was instructed by phone to appear immediately at the law court offices. He was warned against any failure to obey. His outrageous statements that the interrogations were useless, that they could and would yield nothing, that he would refuse to appear again, that he would ignore all summons, whether by phone or in writing, and throw any messengers out the door, all these statements had been entered into the record and had already done him considerable damage. Why was he refusing to cooperate? After all, weren't they attempting to straighten out his complex case, regardless of the time and cost? Was he going to wantonly disturb this process and force them to violent measures he had thus far been spared? Today's summons was a final attempt. He could do as he wished, but he should bear in mind that the High Court could not permit itself to be mocked. Now Kay had set up his visit with Elsa for that evening, and this alone was reason enough not to appear in court. He was pleased he could justify his failure to appear before the court, although of course he would never make use of this excuse, and what's more, would probably have refused to appear in court even if he'd had no other obligation of any kind that evening. Nevertheless, fully aware he had a good excuse, he asked over the phone what would happen if he didn't come. "We'll know how to find you," was the reply. "And will I be punished for failing to come of my own free will?" asked Kay, and smiled in anticipation of what he would hear. "No," was the reply. "Splendid," said Kay. "But then what possible reason do I have to comply with today's summons?" "People generally avoid inciting the court to exercise its powers on them," said the voice, becoming fainter and finally dying away. It would be very unwise not to incite them, thought Kay as he left. After all, one should try to get to know those powers. He drove directly to Elsa without delay. Leaning back comfortably in the corner of the cab, his hands in his coat pockets, it was already turning cool, he observed the busy streets. He meditated with a certain satisfaction on the fact that if the court was truly in session, he was causing it no small difficulty. He hadn't said clearly whether or not he would appear in court. Thus the judge was waiting, perhaps the entire assembly was waiting. Kay alone would fail to appear, to the particular disappointment of the gallery. Unperturbed by the court, he was heading exactly where he wanted to go. For a moment he couldn't be sure that he hadn't absent-mindedly given the driver the court's address, so he called out Elsa's address loudly to him. The driver nodded. He had been given no other. From then on, Kay gradually forgot about the court, and thoughts of the bank began to occupy him fully once more, as in earlier times. Struggle with the Vice President. One morning Kay felt much fresher and more resistant than usual. He scarcely thought about the court at all, When it did come to mind, however, it seemed to him as if there must be some grip, hidden, of course, one would have to feel about in the dark, by means of which this huge and totally obscure organization could easily be seized, pulled up, and destroyed. His unusual state even tempted Kay to invite the vice president into his office to discuss a business matter that had been pending for some time. On such occasions, the vice president always acted as if his relationship to Kay had not changed in the least over the past months. He would enter calmly, just as in the early period of his continuous rivalry with Kay, listen equally calmly to Kay's exposition, show his interest by brief remarks of a confidential and even comradely nature, and would confuse Kay, but not necessarily intentionally, only by refusing to allow himself to be deflected in any way from the main business at hand and devoting himself to the affair literally to the depths of his being. While in the face of this model of conscientiousness, Kay's thoughts would begin at once to swarm in every direction, forcing him to turn the matter itself over to the vice president with scarcely any show of resistance. On one occasion, things got so bad that Kay finally took notice only when the vice president stood up abruptly and returned to his office without a word. Kay didn't know what had happened. It was possible that the conference had come to a proper conclusion, but it was equally possible that the vice president had broken it off because Kay had unknowingly offended him, or said something nonsensical, or because it had become abundantly clear to the vice president that Kay was no longer listening and had his mind on other things. It was even possible that Kay had made some ludicrous decision, or that the vice president had elicited it from him and was now rushing to put it into effect, to Kay's detriment. The affair had not been brought up again, either. Kay had no wish to recall it, and the vice president himself remained taciturn. There were no further visible consequences, of course, at least for the time being. In any case, Kay was not intimidated by the incident, and whenever a suitable opportunity arose, and he felt even partially up to it, he would be right at the vice president's door, ready to enter or to invite him into his own office. Now was not the time to hide from him, as he had done in the past. He no longer hoped for a quick and decisive victory that would free him all at once from every care and automatically re-establish his old relationship to the vice president. Kay realized he didn't dare let up. If he retreated, as the state of things perhaps demanded, there was a chance he might never be able to advance again. The vice president must not be left with the impression that Kay had been disposed of. He mustn't be allowed to sit quietly in his office under that impression. He had to be disturbed. He had to be made aware as often as possible that Kay was alive, and that, like all living things, he might one day show surprising new capabilities, no matter how harmless he appeared at the moment. Indeed, Kay sometimes told himself that he was simply struggling to protect his honour, for in actuality it could do him little good in his present state of weakness to keep confronting the vice president, strengthening the latter's feeling of power and giving him the opportunity to make observations and take measures precisely suited to the immediate circumstances. But Kay could not change his behaviour. He succumbed to self-deception. He sometimes believed quite firmly that he could now compete with the vice president without worrying. The most disheartening practical experiences taught him nothing, and if he failed at a thing 10 times, he thought he could succeed on the 11th try, in spite of the fact that everything went wrong with unvarying regularity. When, after such a confrontation, he came away exhausted, perspiring, his mind empty, he no longer knew if it had been hope or despair that had driven him to the vice president. But next time, it was again totally clear that hope alone impelled him toward the vice president's door. So it was today as well. The vice president entered at once, then paused near the door, polished his pince-nez in a newly adopted habit, and regarded first Kay, and then, in order not to be too obviously concerned with Kay, the whole room as well, in greater detail. He seemed to be taking advantage of the opportunity to test his vision. Kay withstood his gaze, even smiled slightly, and invited the vice president to sit down. He himself dropped into his armchair, moved it as close as possible to the vice president, picked up the necessary papers immediately from his desk, and began his report. At first, the vice president scarcely seemed to listen. The surface of Kay's desk was bordered by a low carved balustrade. The entire desk was splendid work, and even the balustrade was firmly set into the wood. But the vice president acted as if he had just discovered it was coming loose and attempted to correct the problem by banging on the balustrade sharply with his index finger. Kay started to break off his report, but the vice president urged him to go on, since, as he explained, he was listening carefully and following it all. But while Kay was unable in the meantime to elicit a single pertinent remark from him, the balustrade appeared to call for special measures, for the vice president now pulled out his pocket knife, took Kay's ruler as a counterlever, and attempted to pry up the balustrade, in all likelihood to make it easier to push it back in more firmly. Kay had incorporated a completely new type of proposal in his report, one he expected would make a major impression on the vice president. And as he now came to this proposal, he could hardly contain himself, so caught up was he in his own work, or rather so pleased was he to enjoy the increasingly rare conviction that he still was of importance to the bank, and that his ideas had the power to vindicate him. Perhaps this way of defending himself was best, not only in the bank, but in his trial as well. Much better, perhaps, than any other defence he had tried thus far or planned. Since he was speaking rapidly, Kay had no time to draw the vice president explicitly away from his work on the balustrade. He merely stroked the balustrade two or three times with his free hand as he read aloud, as if in reassurance, to show the vice president, almost without realizing it, that there was no problem with the balustrade, and that even if there were, it was more important at the moment for him to listen, and more proper than any repair work. But, as is often the case with active men who devote themselves solely to mental labour, this small practical task had excited the zeal of the vice president. A section of the balustrade had at last indeed been lifted, and it was now a case of reinserting the little pegs in their respective holes. This was the most difficult task yet. The vice president had to stand up and try to press the balustrade back into the desk top with both hands. But in spite of all his efforts, it wouldn't go in. While he had been reading aloud, ad-libbing a good deal as well, Kay had only dimly perceived that the vice president had arisen. Although he had never lost sight of the vice president's activities, he had nonetheless assumed that the vice president's movements were still related in some way to his presentation. So he stood up as well, and with his finger pressed beneath a figure, he held out a sheet of paper to the vice president. In the meantime, however, the vice president had come to realize that the pressure of his hands was insufficient, and so, with sudden decisiveness, he sat on the balustrade with his full weight. Of course, that did it. Now the little pegs went squeaking into the holes, but in the rush one peg broke off, and in another place the delicate upper strip broke in too. "Poor quality wood," said the vice president with annoyance, got off the desk and sat. The building. With no definite purpose in mind at first, Kay had tried on various occasions to discover the location of the office from which the initial notification of his case had been issued. He found out without difficulty. Both Titorelli and Wolfhart gave him the exact number of the building the first time he asked. Later, with a smile that he always held in reserve for secret plans that had not been submitted for his assessment, Titorelli filled in this information by maintaining that the office was not of the slightest importance, that it simply communicated whatever it was instructed to, and was merely the external agent of the vast office of prosecution itself, which was, of course, inaccessible to the parties involved. So if you wished something from the office of prosecution, there were always many wishes, of course, but it wasn't always wise to express them, then naturally you had to turn to the lower office in question. But in doing so, you could neither make your way to the actual office of prosecution, nor ever convey your wish to them. Kay was already familiar with the painter's nature, so he didn't contradict him, nor inquire further, but simply nodded and took note of what had been said. Again, it seemed to him, as so often in the recent past, that as far as torture went, Titorelli was filling in quite amply for the lawyer. The only difference consisted in the fact that Kay was less dependent on Titorelli and could get rid of him easily if he liked. Further, that Titorelli was extremely communicative, indeed even garrulous, though less so now than formerly, and finally that Kay, for his part, could certainly torture Titorelli as well. And so he did in this matter, often speaking of the building in a tone that implied he was hiding something from Titorelli, as if he had established contacts with the office, which, however, had not yet been developed to the point where they could be revealed without danger. But if Titorelli then pressed him for further details, Kay suddenly changed the subject and didn't mention it again for a long time. He took pleasure in these small victories. He felt then that he understood the people on the periphery of the court much better. Now he could toy with them, almost join them himself, gaining for the moment at least the improved overview afforded, so to speak, by standing on the first step of the court. What difference did it make if he were to end up losing his place on the level below? A further possibility of escape was offered here as well. He need only slip in among the ranks of these people. If, due to their inferior status or for any other reason, they were unable to aid him in his trial, they could at least take him in and hide him. Indeed, if he thought it all through carefully and carried it out secretly, he felt they could scarcely refuse to serve him in this way, particularly not Titorelli, since Kay was, after all, his benefactor now, and a close acquaintance. Kay did not nourish hopes of such and similar nature on a daily basis. In general, he was still quite discerning, and was careful not to overlook or skip over any difficulty, but at times, mostly states of total exhaustion in the evening after work, he found consolation in the most trifling and, what is more, equivocal incidents of the day. Then he would generally lie on the divan in his office. He could no longer leave his office without an hour's rest on the divan, and mentally assemble his observations. He did not restrict himself narrowly to those people connected with the court, for here, in half-sleep, they all mingled. He forgot, then, the magnitude of the court's tasks. It seemed to him as if he were the only defendant, and all the others were walking about as officials and lawyers in the halls of a courthouse, even the dullest of them with his chin resting on his chest, his lips pursed, and the fixed stare of someone meditating on matters of great account. Then the tenants of Frau Grubach always stepped forward as a closed group, standing side by side, their mouths gaping like an accusing chorus. There were many strangers among them, for Kay had long ceased paying the least attention to the affairs of the boarding-house. Because so many of them were strangers, he felt uncomfortable regarding the group more closely, but he had to do so from time to time when he sought among them for Fräulein Borstner. For example, as he scanned the group quickly, two totally unknown eyes suddenly gleamed at him and brought him to a stop. Then he couldn't find Fräulein Borstner. But when, in order to avoid any mistake, he searched again, he found her right in the middle of the group, her arms around two men standing on either side of her. That made absolutely no impression on him, particularly because this sight was nothing new, but merely the indelible memory of a photograph on the beach he had once seen in Fräulein Borstner's room. All the same, this sight drove Kay away from the group, and even though he often returned there, now he hurried back and forth through the courthouse with long strides. He still knew his way around the rooms quite well, for lawn passages he could never have seen seemed familiar to him, as if he had been living there forever. Details kept impressing themselves upon his brain with painful clarity. For example, a foreigner strolling through a lobby dressed like a bullfighter, his waist carved inward as if by knives, with a short, stiff little jacket of coarse yellow lace, a man who allowed Kay to gaze at him in unremitting astonishment without ever pausing in his stroll for an instant. Kay slipped around him, stooping low, and stared at him wide-eyed. He knew all the patterns of the lace, all the frayed fringes, every swing of the little jacket, and still he hadn't seen enough. Or rather, he had long since seen more than enough, or even more accurately, had never wanted to see it in the first place, but it held him fast. What masquerades foreign countries offer, he thought, and opened his eyes still wider. And he trailed after this man until he rolled over on the divan and pressed his face into the leather. Journey to his mother. Suddenly, at lunch, it occurred to him that he ought to visit his mother. Spring was drawing to a close, and with it the third year since he'd seen her. She'd asked him at that time to visit her on his birthday, and in spite of several obstacles he had complied with her wish, and even made her a promise to spend every birthday with her, a promise, it must be said, that he had already broken twice. Now, however, to make up for it, he wouldn't wait until his birthday, although it was just 2 weeks away, but would go at once. He did tell himself there was no particular reason to go just now. On the contrary, the reports he received every 2 months from his cousin, who owned a shop in the village and administered the money Kay sent for his mother, were more reassuring than ever before. His mother's vision was failing, to be sure, but Kay had been expecting that for years after what the doctors had said. Other than that, her condition had improved, and various ailments of old age had abated rather than worsening, or at any rate she complained less. In his cousin's judgment, this might be connected with the fact that over the past few years, Kay had already noticed, almost with repugnance, minor signs of this during his last visit, she had become excessively pious. His cousin had described quite vividly in a letter how the old woman, who had previously struggled to drag herself about, now positively strode along on his arm when he took her to church on Sunday. And Kay could trust his cousin, for he was normally over-anxious and tended to exaggerate the negative aspects of his report rather than the positive ones. Be that as it may, Kay had now decided to go. Among other distressing things, he had recently noted a certain tendency toward self-pity, an almost irresistible urge to give in to every desire. Well, in this case, his weakness was at least serving a good purpose. He stepped to the window to gather his thoughts, then had his meal cleared away at once, sent his assistant to Frau Grubach to inform her of his departure and bring back an attaché case in which Frau Grubach was to pack whatever she thought necessary, then gave Herr Kuhner a few business assignments to handle in his absence. Scarcely even irritated this time by Herr Kuhner's rude manner, which had now become habitual, of receiving assignments with his face averted, as if he knew quite well what needed to be done, and endured the communication of these assignments merely for form's sake, and, last of all, went to see the president. When he requested a 2-day leave of absence because he needed to visit his mother, the president naturally asked if Kay's mother were ill. "No," said Kay, without further explanation. He was standing in the middle of the room, his hands clasped behind his back. Frowning, he thought things over. Had he perhaps made preparations for departure too hastily? Wouldn't it be better to remain here? What did he want there? Was he going out of mere sentimentality? And out of sentimentality possibly neglecting some important matter here, an opportunity to intervene which might turn up any day or hour now, since the trial seemed to have been at a standstill for weeks, and scarcely a single piece of concrete news about it had reached him? And might he not shock the old woman as well, without wishing to, of course, but against his will, since so many things were happening now against his will? And his mother was not even asking for him. Previously, pressing invitations from his mother had appeared regularly in his cousin's letters, but for some time now they had not. He wasn't going for his mother's sake, then, that was clear. But if he was going in hopes of something for his own sake, then he was a total fool, and would reap only final despair as a reward for his foolishness. But as if all these doubts were not his own, but being pushed upon him instead by strangers, he suddenly snapped out of his reverie and stuck with his decision to go. In the meantime, the president, either by chance or more likely out of special consideration for Kay, had bent over a newspaper. Now he raised his eyes, held out his hand to Kay as he arose, and without a single further question wished him a pleasant journey. Kay then waited in his office for his assistant, pacing up and down. Saying as little as possible, he warded off the vice president, who came in several times to try to discover the reason for Kay's departure. When Kay finally had his attaché case, he hurried straight down to the cab, which he had ordered in advance. He was already on the stairs when, at the last moment, Kulik, the clerk, appeared at the top, holding in his hand a letter he had started, apparently wanting to ask Kay for some instruction about it. Kay tried to wave him off, but dull-witted as this big-headed blonde fellow was, he misunderstood the gesture and raced after him in perilous leaps and bounds, waving the sheet of paper in his hand. Kay was so exasperated by this that when Kulik caught up with him on the stairs, he grabbed the letter from his hand and tore it to pieces. When, once in the cab, Kay turned around, there stood Kulik, who probably still didn't understand what he'd done wrong, still in the same spot, gazing after the departing cab, while beside him the porter tugged his cap sharply. Kay was still one of the highest officials in the bank. If he tried to deny it, the porter would refute him. And in spite of all his arguments to the contrary, his mother thought he was the president of the bank, and had been for years now. He wouldn't fall in her opinion, no matter what damage his reputation had suffered otherwise. Perhaps it was a good sign that, just before leaving, he had convinced himself he could still seize a letter from a clerk, even one who was connected with the court, and tear it to pieces without a word of apology. Of course, what he would have liked to do best, he couldn't. Give Kulik 2 loud slaps on his pale, round cheeks. This concludes the reading of The Trial by Franz Kafka. This book was read by Jeffrey Howard. If you would like to obtain a mail-order catalogue or additional information about our growing line of audiobooks, write Blackstone Audiobooks, Post Office Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Thank you.